You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. Coming up, we'll talk with a Rhinelander musician and radio host about the ways he's helping shine a light on the music scene in Wisconsin's North Woods. Now, a recent research paper on the Tyrannosaurus rex published in the Journal of Evolutionary Biology stirred up controversy in the world of paleontology. The authors argue that the T. rex we know and love slash fear should actually be split up into three separate species, which could change the way we study the iconic dinosaur. Our guest today says not so fast, and that the fossil record from over 65 million years ago doesn't match the three species theory. Thomas Carr is director of the Carthage Institute of Paleontology, senior scientific advisor for the Dinosaur Discovery Museum in Kenosha, and an associate professor of biology at Carthage College. I spoke with him yesterday. Before we dig into the T-Rex in particular, can you talk about the challenges involved in saying that this is one dinosaur species, these are two separate species, and so on?
Yeah, so that's an issue that is sort of the bugbear of all biologists. Species, when you don't have much information, tend to be kind of fuzzy things. And even then, when you have really good information, even on living species, sometimes the boundary's a bit fuzzy. But basically for fossils, what we do is we pick out features that, say, set a new fossil apart from all others. And we test that by finding new fossils in the same place, in the same geological time. And each new fossil tests that idea of uniqueness. And if, say, a new fossil has the same features as one previously found, then we can be pretty sure that we're arriving at a good concept of one species. So we have to work out the things that we should expect to be different between individuals of the same species. And also, of course, we have to be aware of what makes closely related species different. So it's a sort of a double-layered challenge.
Now, the Tyrannosaurus rex, since I was a kid, I think everybody's regarded that as one species. What are some of the defining things that say, hey, this fossil is a T-Rex and those aren't?
Right. So T-Rex's closest relative is, its name is Tyrannosaurus bitar, and it lived in Asia. And there are many features throughout the skeleton that make them different. One of the first things that really stands out is just how big T-Rex is. T-Rex was the biggest of the Tyrannosaurus, and bitar, in contrast, was a bit smaller. So we have overall size. Also, we have the number of teeth in the jaws of adults. T-Rex can have as few as, say, 11 teeth in its upper jawbone, whereas in bitar, there's 12 in the lower jaw. In rex, it can be low as 12. In bitar, that number is around 15. And there's a whole bunch of other features in the skull that really are easy to pick out in adults as well as young animals.
Well, and here's this paper getting a lot of attention and a lot of skepticism from people in the paleontology community saying, hey, maybe we've got three species here. In a nutshell, what's the argument from this paper, and why are you and others skeptical?
The argument is that the three species can be distinguished based on the overall form of the skeleton. Say, you know, if it's robust, so a chunky skeleton versus gracile, a slender skeleton, and also the number of small teeth at the front of the lower jaw. And one species is claimed to have two small teeth, and the other species have one small tooth. And also, they're supposed to be stratigraphically discrete, but they really overlap, and so we start getting into the issues. The bottom line for me, Rob, is that there's no reason to think, to begin with, that there's more than one species represented by all the skeletons that we otherwise identify as T-Rex. I did a very extensive and thorough study of variation in T-Rex that was published in 2020. I examined 1,850 features to really get at the bottom of, what is going on with the variation we see in T-Rex. And most of it's explained by growth, and the rest of it is what's called individual variation, features that just make an individual T-Rex an individual. And I did find that things like being gracile or robust, and also the form of those front teeth, our noise. It's just individual variation. It doesn't really mean anything biologically at all, except they're just things that separate out individual specimens of T-Rex. These don't segregate out as three discrete groups, and I did include those features in my analysis. And I just do not get three clusters of, you know, that might represent three different species. And so, you know, I find this current study a bit frustrating that it really didn't take earlier work, didn't really take stock of it, and then has just, you know, hung these or named these additional species based on just two features out of, you know, almost 2,000. It just really is quite amazing.
You mentioned a pretty large sample there. How much do we know about T-Rex based on that fossil evidence compared to a lot of other dinosaur species?
Yeah, we know a fair amount about T-Rex. So the sample size for T-Rex is pretty good. For my study, you know, I started with 44 specimens. Their study is, you know, slightly less than that, but comparable. We have many specimens of adult T-Rex. So we have a really good handle on growth variation among adults and also individual variation. And so if there were any species differences among the adults, as the authors claim, there should be way more than just two features, you know, identifying these species. There should be a whole host of other features along for the ride. And we just don't see that. So just, you know, the claim that these three species can be separated on the basis of two features seen across all three species, and in some cases they aren't even different, is really quite an extraordinary claim to make when there's so much other data out there. And I've basically done the work, and I just do not get three groups of adults.
As we wrap up, Thomas, what to you is the biggest unanswered question about T-Rex, setting aside the species argument there?
Yeah, we really don't know much about the early growth stages of T-Rex. So we don't even have, you know, eggs that are identified as T-Rex. So we don't have embryos, we don't have hatchlings. We don't have small juveniles. We've got, you know, maybe one 20-foot subadult. But we really don't have a good picture of how T-Rex grew up in its earliest years. So that is the unknown territory for T-Rex. And that's why it's really important for paleontologists like me to keep going out to the American West to look for more fossils.
Thomas, we'll leave it there. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Thomas Carr is director of the Carthage Institute of Paleontology, senior scientific advisor for the Dinosaur Discovery Museum in Kenosha, and an associate professor of biology at Carthage College. He's with us today talking about dinosaurs and what we do and don't know about the Tyrannosaurus Rex. Right now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Mary Kate McCoy with a story about St. Patrick's Day in Milwaukee.
Everyone's Irish on St. Patrick's Day, they say. Writer Shauna Singh Baldwin married an Irishman and discovered her own bit of Irishness at Milwaukee's annual parade.
If I knew more Canadian women of Indian origin married to American men of Irish origin, I might ask why my husband David has never felt a burning desire to take me to Milwaukee's annual St. Patrick's Day parade. His American accent gives way to Irish whenever he says, "Not at all." Finally, he gave way to my entreaties. He selected his best Kelly green shirt, and I wore a green chiffon sequin-embroidered chunni to drape around my neck on a sunny but cold Saturday in March. We joined the crowd, waving and cheering as floats, cars, and bands made the turn from Juneau Avenue to flow past the Water Street bars. "Bless you," said a huge, smiley man in a white surplice bordered in gold. Mitre in one hand, he folded David into a bear hug and said all his sins were forgiven. I thought he was dressed as the Pope, but David said he was St. Patrick, which made the forgiveness more fun. St. Patrick, I'm told, charmed the snakes out of Ireland. I grew up respecting snakes as protective rather than ignoble creatures that can trick women into errant apple-eating. So I've never been sure he was wise. Mr. St. Patrick posed for photos with a green bodysuited leprechaun and reached up to shake hands with a stilt walker in a tall green hat. When a classic car with a car dealer's ad appeared, he confessed to being a parishioner of said dealership. Smiley auburn ringleted girls and a few young lads from what must be 20 troops of Irish dancers in this city stopped to jig for him. Their rigid, unmoving arms are symbolic of resistance to their British colonizers, a fact my Indian grandparents would understand and greatly appreciate. Seagulls circled and pounced for discarded hot dog buns. We made our way up Water Street the better to hear the bagpipers. I overheard someone say, "I'm calling in sick on Monday." Over the music, a woman beside me in the crowd asked where had I bought my green sequin chunni. I said, "On a trip to Pakistan," and made my usual joke. "I'm IBM, Irish by marriage." "Oh, we're all Irish today," she said, and turned back to the parade. After the bagpipers came members of a Scotch-Irish troupe brandishing swords and stomping along in kilts. Three waitresses with shamrocks painted on their cheeks spoke Spanish as they poured green beer from a barrel. Along came two African-American women carrying a banner advertising Celtic traditions. David and I posed for a photo at Duke's Bar so we could send it to my turbaned Uncle Duke in India. As we walked up Yankee Hill back to our car, David pointed out an Irish flag, noting it has the same colors as an Indian flag. "Right," I said, "and if you don't take me to this parade next year, I'm going anyway." "Promise I will," he said. "I just didn't realize we all need more Irish."
Shauna Singh Baldwin is a writer and the author of several books. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Want to make sure you catch every Wisconsin Life story? Subscribe to our podcast. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. I'm Mary Kate McCoy.
Coming up, we'll talk to a Rhinelander musician and radio host about giving a platform for artists in northern Wisconsin. That's next here on Central Time.
I got the simple life. It seems to be that simple.
This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret, and that's the voice of our next guest, who, besides being a singer-songwriter, is a radio host helping artists from the Wisconsin Northwoods share their music. Scott Kirby is host of the Midwest Music Hour on WXPR and Rhinelander, which airs Tuesdays at 1 o'clock p.m. You can hear archived episodes on their website or at scottkirbymusic.com. Scott, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Rob, thanks so much for having me on the program, man. It's great
to
be here.
Been doing this for about 5 years now, the Midwest Music Hour, working with musicians of all sorts from a pretty wide area and working with them for longer than that. Can you give us a sense of what the show is like and what kind of things you feature?
Oh, well, hey, the show is supposed to be a platform for various artists from around the Midwest or even artists that may be performing someplace in the Midwest. You know, give a nod to the venues hosting the artists and also, you know, them themselves. But basically doing a radio show, you know, if I can have if I got tracks by an artist that I can feature on a weekly program, then I like to do that. And if I got the rare opportunity to have somebody live in studio with me to play a few songs and then, you know, also share some conversation with, that's really spectacular as well. So it's really just, you know, founded on that principle of trying to give artists a platform to be heard and give people out there an opportunity to hear who the artists in their backyard are.
And what made you want to be an evangelist for the Northwoods music scene, the artists, and as you said, the venues?
Evangelist, I like that. Well, you know, and I'm not so sure as much of, I'm not sure about that. You know, I grew up here, you know, graduated from Rhinelander High School, and traveled around the country a little bit playing and, you know, went to school and stuff. But I guess really it bore out a necessity, like most things in life. You know, here's this great radio station, WXPR, and here's a great opportunity to develop a local program to give artists a platform that they won't, you know, wouldn't otherwise have. There's not really, you know, we're kind of isolated up here in the woods. There aren't a whole lot of opportunities for, you know, musicians in those traditional senses, if you will, you know, like you might find in a larger market, like, you know, Madison or Chicago or Minneapolis or New York or Nashville, you know.
That said, you've got a pretty wide variety of artists and genres you feature. Americana, for example, bluegrass, blues, a lot more. Do you have pretty good variety in the Northwoods in spite of that isolation you just mentioned?
Oh, for sure, you know, and I don't, you know, I think sometimes, you know, maybe bluegrass gets a little bit more, or, you know, folk artists, but there are certainly electronica artists, you know, there's hip hop artists, there's heavy metal, you know, and the broad spectrum of genre that entails, you know. Yeah, it's I don't like to just keep it pigeonholed into one genre. I like, you know, like it to be an opportunity for everyone. So
now you shared a couple of pieces of music with us from musicians from the area. I want to start with Bobby Bullitt, a Native American singer-songwriter who's been at the music for a while now. Here's a little bit of his song performed live on your show. The song is May I Lean on You.
May I lean on you for a while. May I lean on Help me find my smile.
Can you tell us a little bit more about Bobby Bullitt and his music?
Oh, wow. I could probably talk all day about Bobby Bullitt. He's man, he's a true gem of Americana, and he's an Ojibwe elder, and I've been just really humbled by the opportunity that I have to work with him in various capacities. This particular song, May I Lean on You, was his entry for the 2021 Tiny Desk Concert competition. And he wrote it about a young girl who was from Milwaukee who had witnessed her father being shot and killed. And he had written that song for her to sing. And, you know, those opening lines in there, they hit you like a ton of bricks, you know. But he's had a really, really extensive career, you know, when Johnny Paycheck and Johnny Cash were in the studios down in Nashville, you know, a young Bob Bullitt was down there, you know, soaking it up a little bit too. And, you know, but he's a healer and he's a storyteller and he carries these traditions that are just, you know, I lack the words to describe them, you know, in a broader sense, but he's just a true gift of a person, and his art just transcends, you know, culture and everything.
We're talking about the Northwoods music scene in Wisconsin with Scott Kirby, musician himself, host of the Midwest Music Hour on WXPR in Rhinelander. Another clip you shared with us, Tuck Pence, another longtime musician. Here's a little of his tune, Life is a Song.
Life is a song I want to sing with you. Got a lot of verses, nothing that we can't get through. Few words might change, but never our tune. Life is a song I want to sing with you.
Scott, tell us a little more about Tuck Pence.
Oh, Tuck Pence is the original American relic. He's been playing music for over 40 years around the entire Midwest and opened for a lot of big shows and made a lot of good records and continues to just be a staple of Northwood's tradition and music, really an anchor in the community, if you will. I go way back because his father gave me my first guitar lesson when I was in the sixth grade, which was something that he wasn't able to do for Tuck. You know, I think his mom told him he could be a dad or a musician, but not both. So Tuck was jealous of that opportunity that I had, you know, way back then. But I've been able to play music with Tuck for about 15 years now, and his songs are incredible. And you know, I play bass with him when we'll do a duo performance, or sometimes we'll have other musicians join in and whatnot. But yeah, if you talk to anybody in the bluegrass community or, you know, or otherwise, you know, Tuck Pence has just been here as a as just a really solid, you know, solo artist. And what can I say about Chuck? My illegitimate father, you know. It's a personal connection there in a lot of ways, but he's got an amazing career himself.
Scott, can you leave us with some encouragement for people around the North Woods to seek out the music scene that might be right there in their own backyard?
Oh, well, you know, what I always like to do is I like to pair good music with good food and good atmosphere. And, you know, tonight I'm at this North Fork Fin and Filet in Arborvita, where they have me every Wednesday. And that's a real treat for me to be here. And, you know, so as people are comfortable and as those opportunities present themselves, you know, yeah, don't be afraid to go out there and support artists, because there's some pretty cool stuff happening in, you know, in the North Woods and in your backyards. And, you know, if you miss it, you miss it.
All right. Well, it's so much,
Scott, so cool. Thanks for the opportunity.
Yeah, have a great show tonight, Scott. I appreciate it.
Absolutely. Appreciate being on the program. Thanks so much.
That's Scott Kirby, musician and host of the Midwest Music Hour on WXPR and Rhinelander. You can find a link to the show and Scott's website at WPR.org/Central Time. He joined us for a look at the Northwoods music scene here in Wisconsin. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, more and more mask mandates are going away these days. Will you keep wearing yours? If so, when and where? A health expert looks at some of the latest COVID numbers and trends and what kind of things to think about when it comes to precautions over the next few months and the rest of the year. And after a lot of loss in the last couple of years, an expert on grief joins the show to share some reassurance and to share some advice as well. We'll meet the author of the new book called The Myth of Closure. That and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time on the Ideas Network. Coming up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then we'll talk to a nuclear engineering professor about a proposed La Crosse utility company considering a return to nuclear energy in the state. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network. Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, the Federal Reserve is raising the interest rate. We'll check out the possible impact and why that's just one factor influencing where inflation goes from here. First, the La Crosse-based utility company Dairyland Power Cooperative is exploring the idea of adding nuclear energy back to its power grid. They're working with a nuclear reactor company to see if it would be possible to install a new, smaller reactor in one of Dairyland's current sites as an additional source of energy. Still in the idea stage, but it's the first sign of interest in nuclear energy since the Wisconsin state legislature removed the effective ban on building new nuclear plants in 2016. Wisconsin currently has one nuclear power plant still in operation. We're learning more now about the proposal and how nuclear could fit into Wisconsin's energy future. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you heard about this particular nuclear reactor discussion in the La Crosse area? What questions do you have about it? Do you think nuclear energy should be a bigger part of the energy mix here in Wisconsin? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@WPR.org. Paul Wilson is the Granger Professor of Nuclear Engineering and the Chair of the University of Wisconsin-Madison's Department of Engineering Physics. Paul, thanks for joining us today.
Oh, it's a pleasure to be here.
Can you talk about this sort of new model nuclear power plant? What could it look like? How it would be different from the nuclear power plants of the past?
Sure. So this concept is being developed by a company called NuScale, and they're the first in line, really, to deploy these new, smaller reactors. This reactor here would be 10 or 20 times smaller than the large reactors we have up at Point Beach or other places around the country. About the same size, in fact, as the La Crosse boiling water reactor that Dairyland Power operated in the 70s and 80s. But I think more important than its size is the way that it's designed. It's much smaller in its physical size. And so it's designed so that it can be built in a factory and shipped to the site. And hopefully that will make things cheaper in the long run once we build many of these kinds of reactors. It also makes it a little easier to start up. You can buy one reactor that's small and start making some money once you're selling the electricity, and use that revenue to help you build and maybe build 5 or 6 small reactors on your site.
Nuclear power used to be a little more common in Wisconsin. You just mentioned the Point Beach reactor, the only one still going now. What led to the decline of nuclear power here in the state?
So one of the challenges for some nuclear power plants around the country and in the Midwest was the low cost of natural gas. So in the early 2000s, we in the nuclear energy community were really interested in looking forward to expansion of nuclear energy. There were about 30 new power plants proposed. And then between the recession and fracking of natural gas, it completely changed the energy market. And electricity became much cheaper, and it really had an impact on a number of nuclear power plants around the country. And so Kewaunee Nuclear Power Plant was closed down in 2013, largely because they could not secure another long-term power purchase agreement with the local utility.
People have concerns about the safety of nuclear power. What do you say to them to alleviate their concerns, especially with this newer idea of how to build a plant?
So these new designs are working in a lot of new safety concepts. This particular design from NuScale is bringing a lot more of the components of the reactor inside the reactor, so there's less parts that could fail outside the reactor. That has a bunch of, you know, without going into the technical details, that has a number of benefits. But another thing that just makes it a different story to some degree is that it's smaller. And the fact that it's smaller means that the risk from any given reactor is smaller. And NuScale has been able to work with the Nuclear Regulatory Commission to get to the point where they're not going to need an emergency planning zone. And so they'll be able to design this reactor with no expectation of a large release of radiation.
Talking to Paul Wilson, chair of the UW-Madison Department of Engineering Physics, professor of nuclear engineering there, looking at the idea of allowing new nuclear power construction in Wisconsin, a plan, an idea in the works possibly for the La Crosse area, still in the study stage. You can join in with your thoughts on that. Your questions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Paul, a concern for many years now has been what to do with nuclear waste. That I said there was an effective ban on new nuclear power plant construction. That was a requirement that there had to be a federally approved waste disposal site. That never happened. It doesn't seem like it's happening now. This is a long-term argument. The state ended that moratorium. But what about that nuclear waste? Where does it go?
All right. So used nuclear fuel that comes out of reactors today is staying at the sites where it was used. So at Kewaunee, at La Crosse still, at Point Beach, fuel comes out of the reactors. It stays in pools to keep it cool for 5 or 10 years, and then it can be moved to above ground storage. That above ground storage is simple and robust and easy to maintain. Certainly, we don't want it there forever, but there's not a lot of technical urgency to move it from where it's sitting right now. It's like I say, it's pretty easy to maintain and store it there, and so that we can explore the right solution in the long term. We know that we will need to build a deep geologic disposal facility. We'll need to put it underground at some point. The Yucca Mountain site in Nevada seems unlikely to ever come to fruition, even though it has a lot of technical merit. But you know, it seems that for a lot of reasons that may never happen. And so we've restarted a new process within the U.S. Framework called a consent-based siting process, where we're aiming to learn how to work with communities so that we can find communities to be willing to host a facility like this. And then we'll store the used nuclear fuel underground.
Now, there's a big concern with climate change, of course, an effort to get away from fossil fuels, the oil, coal, and natural gas, a big effort to boost solar and wind energy. Where do you see nuclear fitting into that picture?
Well, I think they all fit together pretty nicely. When Kewaunee shut down in 2013, It's plain on the record that the emissions of CO2 and climate and greenhouse gases in Wisconsin went up. So whatever aspirations and hopes we had that we would replace the Kewaunee nuclear power plant with renewable energy never came to pass. And so instead, we burn more gas and we burn more coal. And so it's critical to keep the existing reactors open and continuing to operate, because that's been the pattern everywhere in the country and everywhere around the world. We certainly need to be adding more solar and wind. right? Wisconsin has a good climate for wind in some places. It's never going to be a great place for solar, but it certainly is somewhere we should be expanding it. The new O'Brien Fields that UW campus is part of is a great example. And so I think we need to expand solar, we need to expand wind. But there's a growing body of evidence that shows that if we try and rely only on solar and wind, perhaps we can get there, but it's just going to be a really big lift. It's going to be an expensive system. It's just not going to be the best system. We need to pair the solar and the wind and the batteries with other technologies to get the best possible electricity system.
We're talking to UW-Madison nuclear engineering professor Paul Wilson about nuclear energy in Wisconsin. There's a proposal in the early stages looking at the idea of building a smaller nuclear plant in the La Crosse area. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think of the idea? What questions do you have for our guest? Do you want to see nuclear play a bigger role in Wisconsin's energy mix or not? And why or why not? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation, maybe hear from you, coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up the conversation now with Paul Wilson, chair of the University of Wisconsin-Madison's Department of Engineering Physics and the Granger Professor of Nuclear Engineering, with us today looking at a proposal for nuclear energy in La Crosse and what it could mean for energy in Wisconsin. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. With your thoughts or your questions, you can also post your thoughts over on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Let's go to your calls now. Mark is with us in Jefferson. Mark, hi.
Hi. My main concern with nuclear power is the long-term waste, which I understand can be radioactive for thousands of years and just puts a burden on our future generations. And it's an issue we haven't been able to solve for the last 50 years, so who knows if we'll be able to come up with long-term storage in the next 50 or 100 or 1,000 years.
Mark, thanks for that call. We touched on that a little earlier, Paul. You were more optimistic that we can come up with a solution?
Yeah, I'm fairly optimistic that there's a solution out there. We know how to store it underground. We've designed a repository at Yucca Mountain. We've submitted a license application for that repository. The Nuclear Regulatory Commission has reviewed it. We've collected funds from ratepayers and to pay for it. So we've done everything short of issue the license and start operating that facility. So I'm confident that we can do it. In Finland, they've begun operating a repository underground. Sweden is constructing theirs right now. So I'm confident that it's possible to do that. Now, the other thing that we get by not rushing to it, though, is there are a lot of technical solutions that the nuclear energy community has explored to reprocess and recycle that waste. And while that may not be happening in 5 years or 10 years, there may be a lot of motivation to do that in the future. And so having a little more time to figure out really what the best choice is, knowing that a deep geologic repository is viable, gives us kind of a backstop, but opportunity to explore better options in the interim.
Thanks for the call, Mark. We'll go next to Jerry in Rice Lake. Jerry, hi.
Hi. Say, I just had a question about the NuScale. I think the company was NuScale that
right.
You mentioned. I see they signed a development agreement of some sort with Dairyland Power. That's a company that burns a lot of coal. And just wondering, how unique is this design? Is this the only company with a small nuclear reactor, or are there other companies in the U.S. or, I don't know, I guess across the globe that are exploring or doing the same design? Just wondered if the professor could give some insight on that.
Jerry, thanks for the call. Paul, are there other players out there?
Yeah, that's a great question. There are 40 or 50 different private companies that have emerged in the last decade, all pursuing different advanced reactor designs of different sizes. In the last 5 years, I think the most exciting thing is companies looking at microreactors, maybe even smaller than this NuScale design. But within the scope of this NuScale design, there's 10 or 15 companies that are looking at similar sized reactors. But what we see in this last period is a flourishing of companies looking at new ideas, old ideas, things that maybe work better today than they tried in the past, and coming up with reactors at a lot of different scales, and allows nuclear energy to participate in our energy system in a way that it really hasn't in the past.
Thanks for that call. Jerry mentioned Dairyland relies a lot on coal. Wisconsin has historically been a coal-heavy state when it comes to electricity production. Do you see this as a road out of that?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, to get rid of coal, we're going to have to switch to something else. In the near term, we're going to want something reliable, As we build up more wind and solar, again, I think that's a great idea, but we're going to want to match it with energy that we can rely on being there when we need it. And nuclear is a great choice. Without this, what's going to happen if we move away from coal is going to be burning more gas. From a climate change perspective, that's half of a win, but it's not a whole win. And so we're going to want to look at other technologies like nuclear, wind, and solar as the recipe to get us all the way there and reduce our carbon footprint.
Thanks for that call. We'll go next to Steve in Lake Mills. Steve, hello.
Hello. Northern Wisconsin has geologic deposits in northern Wisconsin that are superb for the storage of deep nuclear waste. We could store it in northern Wisconsin. Is there anybody talking about that? And seems to me as though it would be a boon for our economy. We could make millions of dollars in that process. Thank you.
Steve, thanks for the call. Paul, anybody talking about northern Wisconsin as a possible nuclear waste repository?
40 years ago, there was some discussion about that. As the country narrowed down the sites of interest in the federal program to do this, it sort of fell off the map. I don't know if there's an active community up there looking to this, but it is something that's possible. And again, I'll mention this consent-based siting program is a program that is looking to engage with communities in a really meaningful way. Help them understand whether it's an interesting option for them. You know, I expect that many of the communities that engage in consent-based siting may, after they learn more, decide they're not interested, but there may be communities who decide that they are. It could bring some financial benefit. There's sort of interesting new ideas being considered about how to do that engagement and how to understand what is it a community is going to get beyond finances benefit, right? I think there's a long history of kind of paying communities to take these kinds of hazards on. And I think the consent-based siting process and some of the partners I'm working with are looking at how do we actually combine this in ways with things that communities actually want, and not just paying them off, but actually allowing them to have economic development, allowing them to have resurgence in other parts of their economy in conjunction with this kind of opportunity.
Thanks for that call. Mike joins us now in Wausau. Mike, hello.
Hi. I was curious. Years ago, there was a new technology for reactors called a pebble reactor, where the fuel is coated in ceramic balls. And then if something happens, that all the pebbles kind of fall out into a holding areas and separate so the reaction stops.
Mike, thanks for the call. I think the phrase pebble bed reactor sticks in my head, Paul. Has that become a thing?
Yeah, no, that's still under pretty active development. In fact, we have a, like I mentioned, there's a lot of these companies pursuing different things. One of those companies is somebody called X Energy. They have won a big federal grant to build a demonstration plant in Eastern Washington. And so they're working towards building a plant that I think will be two or three times bigger than one of these new scale reactors. But they're relying on these pebbles, just as the caller said, very tiny little, specks of the uranium fuel that then get compressed into a ball of graphite, same size as a billiard ball. And then hundreds of thousands of those fill the reactor and move through the reactor over time to create the reaction.
Thanks for that call. Paul, in just our last minute or so, I know this plan in the La Crosse area is in the very early stages. What, assuming all approvals went through and things like that, what would be the timeline to go from now to a functioning nuclear power plant?
Well, so I mean, it's more than just approvals, right? Mm-hmm. I think Dairyland Power needs to consider this and decide they want to go ahead. And we can't estimate how long that's going to be because they're going to have business considerations and so on. I think from the moment they decided they wanted to go forward, it would still be a number of years till we had a reactor in place. NuScale is planning to build the first of their reactors in Eastern Idaho near Idaho National Lab to be owned and operated, to be owned by a consortium of cooperatives over in Utah and Idaho called UAMPS. They will be the owners of this reactor and it will be operated perhaps by Xcel Energies from based in Minnesota. And so we'll see these and the plan is for them to be in operation in a few years. And so those would be the first of the kind. And then if Dairyland Power were to go ahead, they would be able to follow on the footsteps of that. And fairly quickly, I think, but that's the other thing is that the idea is to build these reactors fairly quickly in a controlled factory environment rather than on-site as large infrastructure projects, which, like any large infrastructure projects, are always plagued by delays.
Paul, we'll leave it there. Thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me. Glad to talk to you.
That's Paul Wilson, nuclear engineering professor at UW-Madison, with us for a look at nuclear energy in Wisconsin, the possibility of new, smaller reactors, including an idea for one near La Crosse. In March 2020, people in a wide array of office jobs found themselves working from home for the first time. While many companies reopened their offices, more employees who can do their job from home say they want to keep that flexibility. Hope Kerwin has more on how workers and their employers are thinking about the future of the workplace.
Marchita Wynn from Middleton was already working from home several days a week before the pandemic hit in 2020. She's an editor at a Madison-based nonprofit that does book and magazine publishing. On days she went to the office, DeWynn says her morning routine was a rush of activity.
Take the dog out, go back in, and, you know, get my bag and jump into the car and set off for the workplace, which is, on a good day, is 30 minutes away.
Like many office workers, DeWynn's routine was turned upside down by COVID-19. In-person meetings became Zoom calls, and hallway conversations with colleagues became email exchanges. And DeWynn enjoyed the changes. She liked not having to burn fossil fuels by driving across town, and she liked getting to spend more time with her aging dog.
I like that it's quiet. I think I was better able to deal with the noise level at the workplace than many of my coworkers, but boy, it really makes a difference.
The perks were enough that even though many of her colleagues are going back to the office, DeWynn says she wants to continue working from home. And she's not alone. A national survey by Pew Research Center found that 59% of American workers who can do their job from home were working remotely all or most of the time in January. Of that group, 61% say that's by choice. Krista Kirsch teaches business management at the University of Wisconsin-La Crosse. She says the pandemic challenged the long-held assumption that office work needed to be done in an office.
Now that that opportunity is clearly available, you can't take that away. Like, you can't unknow that. So I think that's going to be a big long-lasting factor.
Kirsch says the pandemic has made workers more aware of how their job affects their personal life, like the cost of their daily commute or the time taken away from family and friends. And with the tight labor market, employees are more comfortable voicing their preferences. She says, in general, studies support hybrid work, where people have the ability to work from home but are also coming into an office.
Assuming that a job is doable in that format, the research suggests that that job will get done better in a hybrid format than in a fully face-to-face format or even in a fully telework format.
Trane Technologies is an HVAC and refrigeration manufacturer in La Crosse that's embracing these changes. Last summer, Trane announced plans to sell one of their office buildings and have employees who started working from home during the pandemic continue to do so. Business operations director Marty Frank says Trane was beginning to offer more flexibility in where people worked before the pandemic, especially for workers with special skills like being bilingual.
Flexibility is one of those things that we saw as a competitive advantage for recruiting people. It was also something we wanted to offer our employees to maintain and retain the best employees. And we kept edging into more flexibility, and then COVID hit.
While employees in Trane's lab and manufacturing plant continued to come into work, most of the company's cubicles were suddenly empty. These days, Frank said only about 10% of office workers in the building they plan to sell are coming in at least once a week. They're hoping to have more people back in their offices starting in April, when they plan to start what the company is calling the future of work. In order to motivate employees to come back, Frank says they're planning major updates to the office they're keeping, from better lighting to adjustable desks with privacy screens. And they're getting feedback from their employees through an annual engagement survey. Frank sees all of these changes as part of a bigger evolution to office work.
In my management career of 30 years, I would say flexibility wouldn't have never entered into the first 10 years, 15 years of that experience. Everybody came to work 5 days a week. You came dressed up in dress pants and a nice shirt. Today's work environment's a little different.
He says employers like Trane will have to find a way to balance their needs with what their current and potential employees are looking for in a workplace. Working from my home in La Crosse, this is Hope Kerwin for Wisconsin Public Radio.
Coming up after the news is our current 40-year high in the rate of inflation, just a bump in the road. We'll hear what the Fed thinks and how it's planning to do what it can to cool the economy. by raising the interest rate. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.